The zone, the structure plan, so that we all know at the outset what we're dealing with.
Well, I think the best way for me to do it, we don't have Mr. Sargent here again tomorrow, and I have witnesses today, landscape and Mr. Spear, but the structure plan, if I can do it this way, the structure plan is that which is attached to Mr. Sargent's evidence in the chief. Yes, it will be the most recent statement.
Replacement
statement, correct. Mm-hmm. And the provisions, the district plan provisions that are proposed are that which are attached to the supplementary statement.
Right, so if we take that structure plan and appendix A to the supplementary statement.
Correct. Appendix A, so you've got track changes in appendix A.
Yes.
Those are the provisions. Now, I apologise, we didn't give you another structure plan. And if there is any material, aerial photographs or anything like that that helps to let us know, because we can get overlays done as well. I thought about that, but I thought you've got enough paper at the moment, at least you tell me there's something that helps.
We could have a discussion as much about that, perhaps.
I started to put together additional maps, and I thought I'd stop and wait and see how it evolves. So those are the provisions, sir. I might touch on some matters as I go through my submissions about what is intended and what may or may not be clear or delivered on the provisions as they stand. But for example, the question for Mr. Buxton, there is no intention to have rural residential development outside the policy. That's the clear intention. And it's helpful to get those questions because I can pick those up from Mr. Sargent as well. But the remainder of the property is intended to provide for those commercial recreation activities such as trails, access to the SNAs, some interpretive information in that regard as well, but principally be farmed in a less intensive way to maintain rural character. So not quite a show farm or a hobby farm, it's still functional, so it's genuine in terms of visitor experience, but that's the intention. And that's probably that's one reason we can't carry over the rural zone, because it enables more than that. But in terms of just maintaining the land in a tidy manner, it needs to be farmed. You can't maintain it otherwise. So does that help? That's not detailed movement through the provision, but does that help in terms of where we are now, at least with documents that set out the Queenstown Park Special Zone?
That help you?
Yeah. Just on that, sir, Scott talked about replies. Clearly, in this case, the evidence coming out and the interaction with witnesses and the panel is important. And I've filed a summary of submissions which was reasonably fulsome, and then I've used as a template for my submissions. But I would at this stage indicate I might seek leave to do a closing depending on the discussions you have with the witnesses, I think it's more likely than not that there will be improvements in the provisions, if in fact the provisions where we get to within something like 5 working days, sir, so that the council has an opportunity to consider that properly. And I had a discussion with Ms. Scott about the viabilities of CDP, and I think her and I have the same thinking and how you best frame those, but just tidying up matters like that, if that's something that you entertain, I'd make that application probably near the end of the year.
If you were to do that, the latest that we would accept it by is noon on Wednesday the 13th.
I'll hit that deadline soon. That's if we were to agree,
I've set that deadline today for someone else. Mr. Williams actually in his personal capacity.
I'll ask him what reasons he advanced and I'll have to borrow those. It's more to assist the panel from bringing things together if we need to. We'll see how things evolve.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for the indication. So in terms of my submission, I imagine you've read them in the summaries. I propose to laboriously read them out, but speak to certain matters and then receive your questions on them if that's acceptable.
Yes.
So I won't go through the first two paragraphs, but at 1.3 I just emphasise there that landscape values in the locality have been carefully considered by highly experienced experts, and avoiding an appropriate development and impacts on landscape values was and is a key driver for the general development of the zone and the identification of specific development types. And for example, I'll just note there, you'll see at the joint conferencing statement, Mr. Brown and Ms. Skidmore don't agree on reducing RR2. So we've left that as it is, and that's a matter for the panel and my submission following investigation evidence. So there's a difference of view here on the witnesses, and we leave that to be tested. The Queenstown Park Special Zone seeks to enable a tourism recreation hub in carefully located residential development. The range of activities proposed benefit from the rural character of the site and its location near urban areas. A catalyst for the zone was providing a gondola link from the urban area of Frankton to the remarkable ski area. The myriad benefits of the gondola are significant from both an environmental and economic perspective, and it's a potential game changer in my submission from a tourism perspective in Queenstown. It could become an iconic tourist attraction and further enhance Queenstown's tourism reputation. And putting the gondola to one side, the other recreation and tourism activities also deliver standalone benefits in terms of economic growth and opening up private land for public recreation. The QPNZ will considerably enhance the existing trail network and provide access to a high country experience in close proximity to urban areas of Queenstown. Farming, as I mentioned, will continue on the land, and I've just noted my own notes here, no intention, of course, to develop rural residential outside the pots. Take your questions, sir, about farm buildings, and I've had a discussion with Mr. Williams about that, and that's something I'll talk to Mr. Sargent about, clarifying how the area outside the pots, how that works in terms of farm buildings or proliferation of farm buildings. The scale and location.
So I'm just wondering on that paragraph. Are you implying that without the zone, the manner of farming on the land won't respect the environment?
There will always be a balance between achieving a return on the land and doing the best you can to be responsible environmentally. And I would suggest to you that the particular owner of this land would be very responsible. However, the question I think is more important is what does the rural zone promote or encourage in terms of that land use, and if someone is to buy that land and they have to make it viable, then they'll need to farm as intensively as the plan might enable.
And increasing the water.
Correct. Well, yes, and there'll be standards in terms of the water conservation order with the contact recreation standard order. So certainly there are those requirements you have to meet. Having said that, the state of our waterways is a significant national issue, and diversification of land, as Ms. Jews has talked about, is important. And so we're not for a moment suggesting here that an owner would be reckless, but the possibility of a different outcome, a less sustainable outcome from a water quality perspective, is very real in terms of the rural Queenstown Park Zone. But I'm not taking that so far as it's not a threat by any stretch, and it's not intended to be. It's an observation about what the zones envisage or anticipate. In terms of 1.8, I've mentioned the scale and location of built development as an important consideration. That's so obvious I probably didn't need to say that. But you already explored that with Ms. Malsop and the question from Commissioner Crawford about what is the absorption capacity. The real challenge in this, I think, if one is to contemplate activities other than orthodox rural zoning, is the scale and location, just how much can be absorbed. But what I do emphasise, and it's not in my written submissions, is only 5% of this site proposed to be developed in the POTS. It's a 2,000 hectare site, a very large piece of land, so I just need to make that. It's in the surveillance evidence that it's only 5% of this entire property that is in the POT development.
If I could interrupt you there for a minute. Mm. I think your team as a whole needs to clarify where it's coming from with this word urban, because they seem to be all over the place. Ms. Skidmore says definitely not. Mr. Brown says yes. You're saying yes.
No.
Elements of it are urban. And
the position for our team and is that the overall zone will be rural. There are urban elements, but the rural character is retained.
When you see it, if it's legitimate to see it as the whole 2,000 hectares or whatever it is, and even accepting what you say about 5%, but aren't some of the pods, particularly RV3, legitimately of an urban scale? You're not the person to answer that.
No, I think we've grappled with two, and where the experts have got to is overall that it retains rural character. RV3 is undeniably have urban elements. I think it's a question from Ms. Skidmore particularly. She thinks that her evidence is that the spread and the clustering means that they still read as rural. Of course, you have villages in rural areas that won't read as an urban node. That's your evidence. So the position for QPL is it's a rural zone. It's a special zone, but retaining the rural character is essential for how everything else works.
Well, there's a local example that I'm aware of, a different one. I would point to Arthur's point as a distinctly urban village in a really outstanding, within a really outstanding alpine environment.
Mm.
But I don't think anybody would argue that Arthur's point was not urban.
No, I think that's the issue with it here is that RV3 as well have urban elements, but it's essential that the zone as a whole is rural for us. It will lose its tourism appeal, particularly, and taking Arthur's point, your Arthur's point. So that's the intention. That's the scale of the location is designed to maintain that rural character. But I think once you're in the village in RV3, it would feel like what you're describing in urban, a village with urban elements in a rural setting.
So it wouldn't be any different from the way I think.
I don't know Nugget very well.
So you need to get to know these
people. I need to come here to recreate rather than work, so that might help me.
I get too small. I'm thinking Terrence. Yeah.
But certainly those are questions that Mr. Brown and Skidmore have considered. They've been very important questions in terms of the scale and location.
Ms. Skidmore makes a comparison with Millbrook and Wolf Falls Park, and I don't know Wolf Falls Park.
No.
But I'm familiar, a little bit familiar with
the reason for that is in our legal submissions and our case for the rural zone was the urban growth chapter was you could exclude certain areas that are outside the rural urban boundary that might have urban elements but are not caught by the definition of urban development, I think it is. Ms. Skidmore's picked up on that. This isn't like Millbrook.
No, I say the purpose of the exclusion is important.
Yes. Well, the purpose of the exclusion is that if the committee were to form a view that RV3 was urban or there was sufficient urban elements to require the exclusion, you have jurisdiction to do that. If you considered that all other things being considered, it was an appropriate zone from a landscape, economic, and various other issues or considerations that go into the pot. At my paragraph 1.9, I've just said in the context of a district with an economy built around tourism, and I don't want to bang on about that, but it's a clear and significant driver. This zone provides a sustainable and exceptional opportunity to expand Queenstown's tourism offering. And that's the big driver here. And Mr. Sargent talks about the unique characteristics of this land close to the existing urban area connecting to the Spenfield. I'll get to precedent, but the short one is I don't think precedent concerns are significant or shouldn't be significant in my submission. At paragraph 1.10, we've just set out some of the changes and refinements that have come through the process, And I just note there at item B that RV2 and RR7 are no longer pursued. And earlier on, RV1 and RR1 were also removed. So as this process has continued, and we've thought about the concerns of the council, because if the zone is acceptable, we want a zone that the council can administer. Certain areas have been reduced. Those areas weren't by any stretch incapable of development, but they had other challenges, and the decision was made to pursue those that were more concentrated around the gondola area. And in paragraph 1.11, I say it's the case for QPL that the zone is better than the rural zone because it provides for the range of tourism-related activities that will deliver significant economic benefits to Queenstown. Mr. Ballingwall, and you've heard from Mr. Milne previously, officer, on that point, those witnesses that you indicated you have questions for, we've elected to not bring here, but they can, if things evolve, they can be here later in the week.
Just on that point, is the... It's unclear whether the corridor and the zone are both intertwined, or whether one exists without the other.
As we advance them, they are intertwined. However, in terms of your decision making, you have the rural zone, the complete Queenstown Park Special Zone, anything in between. But we advance them as a collective whole, that the corridor that links the zone, that's part of the zone, because...
Not the spending that extends outside the zone.
Oh, no, I understand. That's true. It does extend outside the zone, but my submission to that is that's simply an overlay on a plan map, but that's correct.
That's my question. Is the corridor really just an overlay on the plan map, irrespective of the zone under it?
From a pure district plan interpretation, speaking, yes, that's all it is. It's an overlay. But in the Queenstown Park Special Zone provisions talk about how you develop that within the zone. So it gives light to the overlay. I accept the point, it goes beyond the boundary of the Queenstown Park Special Zone.
But there are no rules in the area beyond the Queenstown Park Special Zone that apply to it.
No, that over the river, that's the issue in terms of over the river and how you... The river banks, I understand, the zoning then will enable construction, pylons.
But it's all zone rural.
It's all zone rural, so you can get through there. The Remarkable Park Zone has zone that enables the construction as well. So it is an overlay traversing three zones, but the Queenstown Park Special Zone is that which gives the most, or gives clarity on what it is, what it's intended to do, and its function. And of course, other developments link to it in terms of the Queenstown Park Zone. It's not a trigger or a catalyst in the other zones. The Queenstown Parks Special Zone delivers ecological benefits both in terms of the protection of SNAs and maintaining water quality. It enhances public access to and along the Kawara or Kawara River, and more generally provides public access to a large country station. It is an efficient use of the natural and physical resources of the QPL land, and also delivers efficiency benefits in respect of the existing use of the adjoining land. In particular, that's the schedule in terms of that connection to that existing tourism and physical resource. It provides an alternative transport option and discourages the use of private vehicles. And on that point, that's the intention is, in terms of the Boyd Road entry, is to have a gate and to try and discourage people coming to the zone from using vehicles. And there's two reasons for that. It's a good thing in terms of discouraging private car use, but it also drives the efficient or viable use of the gondola. The preference is that people use the gondola. Now,
but who would have access through the lockdown?
So the owners of rural residential houses, people in the village, and service vehicles accessing the village. So there is going to have to be some legal access, but what would be explored at resource consent stage is the methods by which to limit that, and that's the intention. It has benefits in terms of the cost, the extent of the road, the standard you have to construct it to, and getting people on the gondola. So the proponents of this zoning are driven to get people onto the gondola. That's a good outcome for them.
So the existing public road?
Yes.
What will happen to that?
Well, that's existing Western public road, so that's there to the void to the edge of the property, and then there's the existing farm road as well.
Mm. Which doesn't follow just the existing road.
No,
it follows the margin of the river.
The road follows the margin of the river, that's right. Mm-hmm. That happens in this district quite a bit, and I don't know if that's an anomaly.
No, it's a standard surveying.
If you practice
worked
it.
In the Bay of Ireland, you'd see the same thing. Yeah.
So the surveying's no intention to have the road on the river edge.
You'll see that all over the place. Would the owners seek to talk to the council about closing that existing unformed?
Well, if you had access to the land wasn't landlocked, I can't see why you wouldn't want to close that road, and it would simply return as.
But that would be
as reserved. That's a discussion with the council.
Well, at the moment, it's acting as a different house, isn't it?
Correct. Mm. And that's probably where it ends up, and it's more appropriate designation for it, or identification for it. At the end of 1.11, I say the rural zone does not deliver, or perhaps more fairly, is unlikely to deliver the above benefits I've identified, and picking up on the point, Mr. Chair, creates a significant, or at least a risk, of environmental degradation of water and soils. SNAs can be grazed without limitation. I rely on Mr. Davis's evidence for that submission, and public access to and along the Quarra River is not enabled. Intensification of farming activities is enabled and can generate adverse effects. At 1.12, the council's opposition seems largely founded on concerns about impacts on landscape, and of course Mr. Buxton has clarified his concerns about how the plan provisions hang together, and we hear that evidence. But the panel is tasked with evaluating the competing evidence in that regard. But I respectfully make the following submissions that I say are relevant to your evaluation of that. There is no evidence that the district is at or near a tipping point where development within or adjacent to ONLs is damaging Queenstown's tourism appeal. And that's really picking up on the evidence of Mr. Osborne that we don't want to destroy the goose that laid the golden egg, but I haven't seen any evidence that suggests that the tourism appeal is under threat by development in and around ONLs.
What's particularly, is that relevant to us?
Yes, I think so, in terms of sustainable management and economic well-being, as well as...
A tipping point is a pretty low bar.
Oh, well, when I say tipping point, we think of 50, well, I'm saying we're miles away from the tipping point, so I think if you're right, if you're getting close to that, you probably want to react well before you reach the tipping point, but there's no evidence in my submission that suggests we're even in the realm of contemplating that there's a shift, that there's that sort of damage and that sort of risk.
But going right back to the RMA, where does the concept of a tipping point feature in there?
So I'm using in terms of what the evidence that's in front of you in terms of that risk. I'm not suggesting the RMA says there's a tipping point. What I'm saying is that Mr. Osborne has suggested we need to be careful about ONLs and the relationship to
it. I understand that, but I'm just wondering where in an RMA process tipping points even become relevant.
Well,
because as I say, it's a very low bar. When you get anywhere near it, you're going to have a substantially degraded landscape.
The horse's bottom. Well, I say is at or near a tipping point. What I would say is it doesn't seem to me to be any genuine analysis that suggests there is even the existence of a genuine risk at the moment that development in around ONLs is threatening Queensland's tourism appeal. I haven't seen it.
In general. But you still have your statutory responsibility on this particular site to protect the ONL from inappropriate development. So
I don't deny that completely. If your section such responsibility is to protect the ONL from inappropriate subdivision use and development, I don't dispute that. I could have, it's in the Act. This is more about the economic evidence in terms of the contribution those own out to tourism and how you best manage that.
It's sounding a little like an argument to say you can do things on this site because there's plenty left elsewhere.
Well, it's not as simple as that, and I apologise for giving you that impression, but it is to say that there are, you need to think carefully about this site, but the district is blessed with ONLs and grappling with the fact that I think it's 97% of the district is ONLs and how you factor that in as well. But no, it's not saying, look, there's plenty around. We have to consider the site-specific features of this and you have to assess the evidence in terms
because
of
while that 96 or 97% figure is routinely quoted, I don't know the figures, but I'm guessing most of that is a great deal more remote from Queenstown, for example, where everybody comes in this particular side of it.
Yeah, and I think that cuts both ways too about whether the proximity to the urban environment is a positive thing or a negative thing. We say it's positive in terms of access and the context Mr. Brown talks about. The further out you go, the more remote experience you get. But to come back to Section 6, I don't dispute for a minute that you don't have to look at the values of this site and assess them as you're required to under Section 6 and 7. I completely accept that. At item B, I say Mr. Brown's evidence is the most comprehensive analysis of effects on the O&L. And of course, Ms. Mousel has come in and undertaken a review, but he's come from a ground zero approach to looking at the O&Ls. And it is complemented by Ms. Skidmore's analysis of the proposed development of POTS. The build media visual simulations are an important reminder of the immense scale of the Northern Remarkables landscape, which in my submission is relevant to its capacity to absorb development.
Just on the visual simulations, why are the visual simulations limited purely to the gondola rather than all the other development that's proposed?
It was a much capacity of what they could produce in terms of modelling that entire area. So the short answer is that was the brief. So there's no reason to hide the pods. The primary aspect of the site we wanted to understand or wanted to assist Mr. Brown with was looking at the gondola and seeing how that went and how it was modelled. The other difficulty with the pods is there's been one mock-up that has been attached to Mr. Brown's evidence. It's what do you model in the sense of the pod and an indicative development, whereas we knew where the gondola was most likely going to go. Mr. Spears talked about that, so we could model that in a reliable way. But no, if you don't have that, you don't have that information, I accept that. The landscape evaluation process undertaken by QPL's experts has resulted in the removal of some proposed development areas, and we've touched on that already. At item E, the higher level scheme of the district plan does not prohibit development within O&Ls. Rather, it seeks to avoid appropriate subdivision use and development. In that context, Ms. Malsop's evidence that the effects are not dependent on whether or not the change is visible seems out of step with a higher level approach. And you'll be more familiar with those higher level strategic direction objectives and rural and landscape objective policy serve. So the thrust of the submission there is that there is development of no hours is not foreclosed by the council's current proposed position on the proposed district plan. Background of previous submissions, so I propose to go through that. That's just in there in terms of how QPL and RPL participated so far in the hearing process. And is really there in terms of jurisdiction, should you need it. The legal frameworks, too, you'll be familiar with, I'm sure you'll have heard a chapter and verse, the basic framework, and so I don't talk to labour through that, but I want to put that in there. So that was in my submissions. At 3.4 in terms of section 5, I've said there I don't think it's helpful to isolate particular aspects of the definitions of sustainable management. Clearly, outstanding natural landscapes are important in this case, but I say the definition should be read as a whole, although the management function as identified by council for the council is important and land management is a feature of the zone. Now, 23.5, it is submitted that an overall board judgment approach remains valid unless there is a higher order document that is determinative of a particular environmental matter. And in my submission, that's not the case here. Mr. Sargent's evidence addresses the relatively orthodox language of the regional policy statement, which anticipates a district level response to balancing protection of O&Ls whilst providing for activities such as tourism. It is submitted that all relevant policy matters need to be considered, weighed, and evaluated. And I've just referred there to the Turners and Growers.
Just before you go on to that, what about if chapters 3 and 6 is recommended by the Turner and Growers?
Well, recommend, yes,
by a panel.
Well, if you reached a view on chapters 3 and 6 that on the evidence you viewed there that foreclosed, but that had highly the policies, such as the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement, is a two-minute issue, unless there was an express exception within the scheme of the plan of the Queensland Park Special Zone, no, you shut the door because it would cascade down. So I accept that. I don't know what your thinking is in terms of those chapters, but if the rural or the landscape chapter had a strong and unequivocal policy on O&Ls, then you couldn't say that the zone gave effect to those vital or objective policies.
Yeah, but they do have to be. You have to be consistent within the plan.
Completely. And that's why, and we've come along those hearings to express views in terms of what latitude those chapters might allow. But yes, if the panel, after hearing all the submissions you have heard, reached a view on a two-minute policy in Chapter 6, that would be the end of it based on things now. Having said that, I'd always loathe to get into the target of King Salmon, but we read it a lot when it first came out.
Mr. Robinson, that's right.
And also, Commissioner Mouth has made the point about, it's a fair point, just because there's a lot of O&L, doesn't mean you just say, okay, well, they'll put their hand up, give them a sign on, trying to understand the point there. But what comes out of King Salmon that's quite important, and the reasoning is that the NZ Coastal Policy Statement was dealing with a limited resource and was a small part of the coast they were trying to protect. So it is what it says. And I think that context is important to bear in mind that there is.
Aren't we here dealing with a limited resource?
Yes.
It may not be limited in terms of this district, but it is limited, isn't it?
Well, all resources to some extent are limited. Yes, it is. But this district is potentially less. Sorry.
It's not replicable elsewhere. You couldn't substitute somewhere else for this area.
I guess the extent of uniqueness of the landscape is relevant to its categorisation up and down the country, and everything's different. And I'll refer to the Variation 12, the Rotorua Lakes District case, which was one of the first cases I did as a young lawyer. And having not been to the Lakes A Zone, that's a completely different experience with the top of Tarawera ripped off and all that dense bush, which is quite a different experience of this. But and that's not replicable. Lake Waikato Island is another, I'm more familiar with the Central North Island having grown up around there. But no, every resource is limited. But I do think it must be relevant to your evaluation that Queenstown has so much land as O&L in terms of how you approach sustainable management within those areas.
It doesn't Rotorua Lakes have, Rotorua District have the same, because if you take the lakes, I have to confess I grew up in Rotorua too, so I understand this quite well. If you take those lakes, that lake area, that's a big chunk of the district.
It is, it's certainly not, I'm trying to think back now, it's certainly not the scale of the O&L in Queenstown, but that is a big chunk of the district. The real issue that emerged there, you had existing settlements, which there wasn't a great deal of pressure, but it was how you dealt with Māori buildings and how the iwi, a lot of the land that was looked to be protected was owned by iwi, and their driver was having some sort of papakāinga housing.
Yes.
Really, just so people could come home.
So there were different issues.
Yeah, different issues.
Six issues in play as well.
That's right. But similar drivers, and I think former Principal Judge Fires comments about a dead hand, and I don't want to catch the fires or overstate, but finding that balance in these O&Ls is what we're driving at here, that we've already heard from the council's witnesses, look, there is some ability to absorb change, there's a difference of opinion on that. But getting people into O&Ls as well, and being able to experience them, there must be value in that from our own perspective also. But yes, it's a finite resource.
Just on that, Mr. Brown's notion of the access, improved access into rather inaccessible areas as a landscape value in itself. Do you support that?
I do. If you can't, Mr. Brown would be a better place to expand on that, but to experience landscapes as well, not just from a distance gaze at them, but to be in them, I mean, there must be value in that. To actually be able to be within an O&L and experience an O&L. It's not just a postcard, it's an environment to be in. There's all sorts of experiences, climactic, whatever it might be. So I do think that's...
The Act is broad enough to enable that perspective?
I think it is, as long as it's mean, it comes within the purview of an appropriate subdivision use and development, provided it's not an appropriate, those values are maintained, the ONL is still an ONL on the evidence, then you must have achieved protection. There's a balance in all of that. But no, I can't cite a case to you, so I'd be a little careful. But my view hasn't been that ONLs are something to be viewed from a distance and not actually engaged with physically.
No, it's the level of if you're doing it. For example, I can think of, let's go to somewhere else, Mount Cook.
Yes.
And that Hooker Valley Trail, which must be traversed by thousands of people every day, but it's still, apart from the people, the trail itself treads fairly lightly on the landscape.
That's true. It's the level, the scale of what you propose to do.
And yet it gets people up and close to two glaciers and a whole lot, and Mount Cook itself.
Mm. Yes, I'm going to ask for the best I can. But no, I support Mr. Brown's position.
In theory, that is.
Engaging with the landscape
yeah.
is a benefit.
Yeah.
But I take your point about how do you do that, or the effects of that, and what's the scale of that. Now, I should note, my preference is to engage as I go, so I'm not having any problem with any questions. Get into it, yeah. And I'll refer to that on the, so that's King Salmon and Variation 12 into the Rotorua Lakes District. And I'll just refer to the High Court in Turners and Grower Horticulture Limited and the decision there talking about King Salmon and how that was applicable to particular facts of that case. Now, the High Court appeal didn't go, that decision didn't go any further. But I'll just emphasise some passages there for you in terms of the overall board judgment. I mean, I don't want to be simplistic about this, but I do think it's even simpler than that. I think the King Salmon case and its concerns about overall board judgment are very much related to the facts of that case and the planning documents that sat there. And I don't think you could discharge almost the valuable task you've got here without an overall approach.
Isn't the Turners and Grower's was the same one, same though, where they had very broad objectives and policies to deal with in the plan itself.
Yes.
So it comes back to what I asked you before. If the strategic factors, if they remain broad and affirmable, if avoid remedy and mitigate every effect, then we have to go to the higher order. But if they are more determined as to what is appropriate or inappropriate, then you just don't need to go further.
You shut the door at chapter 6, you shut the door, that's yes. The fact that I've said that.
Yes.
But we, I guess, we relied on note 5 and recommended provisions, but of course, we're trying to stitch together Queensland Park Specials, like you've got a much broader task of stitching together the whole plan. And part 2, part 3, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4, what the implications are as you go down to. So I won't read that out. Section 6 at paragraph 3.8, I identified section 6 A, B, C, and D. Those will all be familiar to you. Now the word margin, so 3.10, I went to the word margin, and that's come up in the evidence more, and I think I've got a solution to that that takes away from trying to get too far into the what is a margin where the wave action is. Given you've got a deep trench river too, it's slightly different. But the short point is the land, the Kawarra River, the valley, the floodplains, the steep slopes have all been assessed by Mr. Brown and Mr. Skidmore and Mr. Malsop. So you have evidence that covers all of the landscape aspects of this area. And if you were to find that the outstanding values weren't retained in a particular part where it's a margin otherwise, that's going to be your approach to section 6A and 6B. We don't need to give them.
We don't need to divide it between the two.
The only caveat to that would be if you're of the view that the pods nearer the margin, wherever that might be, were more concerning, that you might want to change the shape of the pods or pull things back. But again, that's a 6A, 6B assessment in the round as well. So I don't think I need to complicate that issue without having to try and identify where the margin is here. It's part of your evaluation.
Mm. What about those things that do actually extend into or across the river?
Well, those will be relevant to section 6A.
And the natural character.
Natural character, yes. at 311, what is inappropriate, because you have that inappropriate subdivision use and development phrase in those two key sections, should be assessed by what is sought to be protected and will be heavily influenced by context. And just have that quote from King Salmon, the contextual aspect being tested to some extent by Mr. Mountford with Ms. Malsoff. That's something that Mr. Brown deals with in his evidence. And I won't talk about King Salmon again, so that's the last part of that. Section 6B is of course relevant to the classification of the land. We don't dispute the ONL classification. That's what's appropriate within that ONL. Mr. Brown has undertaken a detailed assessment of the Queenstown Park Special Zone and concluded that the values of the ONL will be protected. He notes that the ONL has both cultural and natural elements, and the gondola has a surprisingly light footprint in the spectrum of naturalness. The landscape is far from pristine, and the existence of cultural elements is relevant to the potential effects of the QPZ. Having read that submission, that's really just Mr. Brown's evidence, not for me to say in any case, but that's where he has gone in terms of his assessment. I won't go through 313 and 314. It touches on the evidence. That's an issue for you. It's not for me to tell you what to do on the awkward issue. That's for you. And then over the page, we get to the Tarawera Lakes decision with former planning, principal planning judge Bollard. That was an interesting reason. The council released its plan in 98 or 99. Sort of put the lakes in the too hard basket, and then Robin was saying, no, you need to deal with it now. And that's how the variation development came about. And Judge Kirkpatrick was then counsel for the Kaitiaki Tarawera, and they were a very strong group in terms of the preservation of the lakes. And there was a concern that there was going to be this dead hand, and there were these tensions between the existing settlements at Karaka and Okataina, I think they are. Better not than I. And that's where this statement from His Honour, Judge Bollard, comes into context. This is a direction to the council to go away and do the variation, which is in the decision on the actual variation. That the lakes environment, this is at later 192 in the middle of my quote of passage there, the lakes environment is a precious heritage to be cherished and protected. The RMA properly invoked and applied demands no less at a district plan level. Commensurately careful consideration must be afforded because of the environment's fragile nature, the ease with which the natural character of the general area can be altered, whether by development sporadically located or by ongoing expansion of existing settlements, and the comparative difficulty of stemming, let alone reversing established changes in accompanying trends. By these remarks, we do not mean to convey that a dead hand must be placed on the Tarawera Lakes, and the catchment designed to maintain the status quo at all costs. What must be done, however, is to analyse and determine the degree of change that can be accommodated within the planning period so that the natural and physical resources of the area are sustainably managed. The inherent attributes of the area must not become eroded even to a careful degree, with an outcome evidencing non-sustainability and a discount of legacy for future generations. I'll simply say that's a similar task here. What is the degree of change that can be accommodated within the planning period? My submission is a key consideration. At 315, section 6C is relevant to the identified SNAs, and on the evidence is concluded that the Queenstown Park Special Zone protects SNAs because it relieves pressure to develop a viable farming operation which would necessitate, or could necessitate, more intensive high country grazing. Just an interesting conundrum falls out of that submission in terms of your evaluation of the rural zone. And while I'm rather focused on Queenstown Park Special Zone, given that evidence, Mr. Davis accepts that the Queenstown Park Special Zone is better from an ecological perspective than due to protecting SNAs, the question becomes whether the rural zone, with what it does, is meeting your Section 6C directive. So that's you're comparing those two zones, of course, and we say in this hearing, or something in between. So it's not so much, it seems, on the evidence that the Queenstown Park Special Zone achieves that protection. One of the challenges is whether the rural zone does, and that's got implications in this case, but perhaps more widely in terms of the district plan.
Can I interrupt you in that?
Yes.
Just a matter of sequencing. I can't remember from the provisions when that obligation kicks in. Is it because it's unclear to me what at the moment what's going to come first, whether the gondola is going to come first, whether you're going to start doing rural residential pods first or cycle trails first, or what. So at what point, for example, would that obligation to restrict the grazing in the SNAs kick in?
I haven't checked that it kicks in once you undertake the first stage of development under the Queenstown Park Special Zone, i.e. a CDP for one of the pots. So that's part and parcel of the first steps of development, the Queenstown Park Special Zone. But if that's not clear, and I'll check that with Mr. Sutton, that's my understanding, it's probably a question that I see to make sure I'm correct on with him.
So the intention is that it kicks on immediately.
That benefit is accrued immediately upon development reliance on the Queenstown Park Special Zone provisions. I make it quite clear that the benefits that we say put forward here in terms of trails and types of SNAs are intended to kick in when you undertake development of the zone. If that's not evident or not obvious, the provisions in.
Well, I'm not sure, so I'm just asking.
No, I totally understand. But that's what's anticipated. That's the package.
And see, that is one of the difficulties at the moment, because the zone as a whole enables a number of different things, and it's very unclear sort of the sequence, or even if your client even knows the sequence and which thing might.
Well, there is, yes, there is a desire to have some flexibility in terms of the sequencing.
And how far they might eventually get.
That's right, the rural residential pods are limited in numbers. Mm-hmm. The gondola is a significant financial undertaking, and it's the ability to get the joint venture partners. Yes. That confidence can be done. But time, maybe some time to get that underway. But that's. Yeah, that's a matter that it's not clear on the provisions, and the view of the panel is that it needs to be clearer or more certain.
And one of the implications, thinking it through, and we're getting away from the original question, is that if you were to go ahead with the rural residential first to any extent, then the road is going to have to be done early, and that's going to get people into the habit of using it.
Well, the people who live in rural residential will be in the habit, they will have access anyway.
I know they will. But Mr. Penny tries to persuade us that the gondola will be such a good thing that people, if they're going out for the day, for example, won't do it. They'll hop on the gondola instead.
It's better to change the habit at the front end than once the habit's been.
I mean, when I read that, I was quite sceptical about the thought of a whole family sort of getting the shuttles at the station and then taking the gondola and then getting a bus into town. But I'll take that up with Mr. Penny.
No, I'm just looking at the intentions of the gondola. I mean, the gondola is such an essential part, or such an important part of the overall development, when you talk about the full package that's proposed.
All right, that's an observation. I fully understand that in terms of day visitors and people who are coming to stay in an RV3 in the visitor accommodation and all that.
Mm.
I'm going to be convinced that the gondola will be play a significant part in the life of rural residents in the pods.
Make sure Mr. Penny's ready to answer that question. Section 7, I've gone through Section 7 and I'll focus mainly on Mr. Ballingall's economic assessment in terms of the efficiency requirements of Section 7B, which link into Section 32. Unless there's any particular questions on that, I don't propose to go into any detail on Section 7. I'm not trying to say they're not important, they are important factors in the part two, but they're probably sitting at the second tier in terms of SNAs and landscape factors in this case as well. But of course, the economic well-being in terms of tourism in this district is an important part of section 5 and part 2, and that's why Mr. Ballingall's done the analysis he's done. And as I said earlier, you've heard from Mr. Mill about the ski industry, challenges it faces and the importance of it to Queenstown.
I just wondered if your assessment in respect of section 7i in paragraph 323 is actually quite part of the right way around. I thought Parliament had restricted us to considering the effects of climate change.
Yes, no, you're right. I looked at that when I was reading it outside. You can strike that from my submissions. No, sorry, I meant to do that. No, you're right. And so, you can strike that too. Section 32, I'm comfortable with the opening submissions of Council and the Council in terms of Section 32. You'll all be familiar with Section 32. At 3.25, it is submitted that the opportunities for economic growth and employment are relevant, particularly relevant to the panel's evaluation of the QPSZ in determining whether it's better. And then I've, at 3.26, summarised parts of the evidence of Mr. Milne and Mr. Ballinwall, and I'm sure you'll have questions for them, particularly Mr. Ballinwall, in terms of his economic assessment and the benefits of the additional tourism spend over 35 years that he's identified.
You've made a statement in 3.26 that a gondola such as this is simply not viable under the rules of this. The only question is whether which part of your evidence supports that statement.
But that'll be something that Mr. Porter can speak to, yeah. Or Mr. Bellingham, but the costing is around $80 million, for a 10-kilometre, 27-minute gondola ride. And my understanding, and Mr. Porter can speak to this, from his perspective as the landowner of his own rural, this proposal would just knock off the ground.
Because it needs all the other activities.
Yeah, there's that, it needs, in terms of attracting investors, having some sort of village where people can get off and have something to eat or drink, and opening up the other tourism opportunities and property.
So on the assumption then that all those other, I won't say peripherals, but you know, things that go with the gondola are not viable themselves in the rural zone. Or it'd be too difficult to establish or too uncertain or...
Sorry, the rural...
I understand the basic argument that the gondola itself needs to be supported by other economic or money-generating activities, be they rural residential or visitor accommodation or recreational activities. I understand that. So there has to be an assumption that the rural zone then is a barrier to the creation of those.
Well, the rural zone doesn't have any minimum lot size, so you could run a series of resource consents for rural residential development that you may or may not get. The key with this is the certainty that the zone would provide in terms of the gondola development and associated facilities. I mean, it's a special zone, and if the gondola was approved, it becomes a physical resource of which other activities could benefit. Again, the question of scale and location, but the certainty of a zoning that has a corridor, a specific set of assessment criteria for a gondola and has gone through this process, delivers that at a much more certainty than a rural zone.
Well, I understand why all the provisions relating to the gondola of the system. Excuse me. But it's the assumption that those other facilities just couldn't happen in the rural zone, which one?
I think that there is the opportunity for commercial recreation activities and recreation activities in the rural zone. They do have footprint limitations, and Mr. Sardin can speak to this as well. I think it's unlikely, though, that you would look to develop those without a anchoring development like a gondola that attracts people to come to that area. It gives them a reason to be there and experience to be there. And so, as I say, there is a package with this that enables the development to be undertaken and to be seen to be viable and commission and certain that it can be delivered.
With the stated economic impact in this section, on the basis of those submissions, then the non-monetary effects of all the ancillary activities that are included in the zone have to be offset against that movement.
Yes. Into an overall board judgment, yes, that's correct. There are benefits and costs in your proposal, and they go into the mix in terms of your evaluation. Now, in terms of section, section 74 to 75, I skipped through those in terms of the ORPs. The short point is that the proposed regional policy statement is subject to challenge, and there's sufficient uncertainty in my submission to place a little weight on it at this point in time. There are further mediations scheduled, and some matters are set down for hearing, so we really are left with the operative regional policy statement as the primary document at this point.
What will happen? The unfortunate situation where the RPS becomes operative before the council delivers its decisions.
I would recommend to you that you direct any party to make submissions on it at that time, and then you would have to factor it in. But I don't think you're going to have an operative RPS or a close to unchallenged provision for the RPS this year.
April next year or May next year.
Well, in Black and Waimakariri District Council, the court did that very thing and filed submissions on the new unchallenged or sufficiently certain provisions of the proposed RPS and what that meant to the evidence. In that case, it didn't mean a great deal. And whilst I don't know the outcome, I would anticipate that the proposed document will not be any more restrictive than the operative document. It may in fact be more enabling. I certainly don't see it going in the direction that's any more restrictive than the operative document.
Because nobody's asking for that.
There are people who are the EDS, Forest and Verdure in there, but with the outcome of King's Salmon, there's been a focus on protecting values of our savage landscapes, not avoiding the effects of any activity. So that's been a shift to understanding the values, and that's given all parties enough of an understanding of how things might proceed, so a better response to the King's Salmon case. There's the full spectrum of interests are well represented and stridently pursuing their ambition. So, So 3.37, I have put the two policies of policy 1.1.1 is all but agreed, but it's not agreed, so I can't. And then 3.2.4 is the one that's still subject to concern, principally the coastal environment, but then whatever happens to that may have implications to the rest of the document. So giving effect to any national policy statement at 3.39, we have the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management that Mr. Sargent comments on. And then at 3.40, the National Policy Statement on Indigenous Biodiversity was referred to in the 42A report. And I said in my summary, and it's in here, that is not really, it's not operative. So it's, I think, I'm not being too flippant about this, it's gone too hard past it. So we've got Section 32 of submissions, and it was in 2000 and it's paused, and I can't find out why. I can speculate as to why, but so I don't.
I'm quite happy to say it's not on the agenda.
I don't think either. And if you wanted to revise that submission, it's up to you whether you turn your mind to it or not. But I think the issues that it sought to address are in the Act, so I don't think you need to look at it. And so when I say, does it prevent you from considering it, you're not bound to give effect to it, I think it's probably even less relevant than that. So I just want to revisit that submission because you've got Section 6C and 7D matters dealing with the same issue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Hey, Mr. Young, I'm currently facilitating a collaborative process to develop a new version of the biodiversity. Well, wish me luck.
I was hitting dead ends as I followed links through various websites.
Yeah, some Federated Farmers and Forests and Bird so far. and several other parties in a small collaboration, and it's due to report September of next year.
Well, it's just a couple of notes, so...
Yes, so, and Mr Chair is correct, it's never been notified.
Is that right? Because all I can find was a Section 32 evaluation and some submissions, so that led me to believe that...
It founded on sort of advanced exposure drug level, might be the best way of putting it, in 2011.
Right, yes, yeah, that was it.
No,
there was a bit of an internal office discussion trying to work out, you know, number of petitions, where was this document at? And it was quite a high level of lack of knowledge.
No.
Yeah. So, look, it's mentioned, but it's probably not a really great moment in this hearing. Give effect to any RPS. I said I wouldn't talk about King Salmon again, but there's a quote there about implementing and giving effect to it. There's nothing extraordinary about that. Those are well-established principles. In terms of giving effect, it's a strong direction. And we don't resolve from that. You've got the regional policy document, what it says about everything else. So I won't go through 3.2.
Well, isn't the simple answer with the operative regional policy statement that's so broad that it's not helpful?
Well, I'm glad you've said that, and that's certainly a view.
You've got all the CJ applications for some time as well.
Yes, no, I understood. I think that if I could speak to the regional council, I would say that it's good that they haven't predetermined issues for additional people, but equally, the way you've characterised it is also true as well. 75.4b, not inconsistent with the regional plan. They've touched on the regional plan more again. That's a matter for evidence. In terms of the Kawerau River Valley and the river and an ONF, I'm working off memory here. In terms of Schedule 1 and 1A of that plan, there is a note about those characterisations saying this is a starting point. This is a starting point. Having a look at your various stretches of river and looking at the values and identifying matters at a district level. So whilst Mr. Barth's right, there is that schedule, it's not conclusive on the issue, and they make that qualification. This is a starting point evaluation. So that's all I've mentioned there. Scope issues.
Just before you go on to scope, with the regional plan water and its setting of appropriate nutrient levels acceptable into the receiving water courses. I don't recall giving any information on this zone as to how wastewater and stormwater is particularly dealt with.
It's in the evidence of Justin Robson.
Is it?
Yes, in terms of the three waters. And
is it detailed as to whether it's an improvement on water quality likely from the existing productive use of the land?
I don't know if it goes to that detail, but we can ask about that. Mr. Robson explains how that would be dealt with, and I'll take your point about what the implications are for water quality. So I'll ask.
So because the regional, the water conservation order does have a requirement that there be no. And it's effectively no increase in nutrients because it's no additional growth in the water body, so that might
that's
be
right, to keep that CR standard. I know Justin Robson talks about how three waters be managed and issues we've raised in terms of the viability of that, but I take it as a different issue to water quality, so I'll ask about that.
Okay. Well, before we move on to scope, which is we might need to go through here to here. Where were we doing for that?
Just why, I was going to not go through scope at all. Only because I thought the issues had been resolved.
Okay.
But if there is something, maybe we can get heads up.
Even if we don't, then we're going on to copy.
No, that's fine. I'm having a break.
Which we will need to go through very carefully.
Yes. No, it's just this. Yeah. All right. Thank you, sir.
So we will return at 2 p.m.
Thank you.